The next case on the calendar is United States v. Jones.
May it please the Court, my name is Jay Osiadich and I'm here on behalf of Mr. David Roy Jones. We're requesting that the Court vacate the judgment in this case and remand the case to the District Court for reconsideration of his his suppression motion. The question before the Court is whether Mr. Jones was collaterally stopped from challenging in federal court the search and seizure of evidence because he pleaded guilty to unrelated charges in Tennessee State Court. We are challenging five state-issued warrants on the grounds that they lack particularity and were not based on probable cause. We're also challenging a federal warrant on the ground that any evidence produced from that warrant was the fruits of an improper state warrants. The District Court denied Mr. Jones' motion to suppress the evidence on the grounds that he was challenging the federal courts on the same evidence that supported his Tennessee sexual exploitation charges. The Court also determined that the good faith exception applied in this case. We believe that the Court made an error of law in reaching these conclusions and the case needs to be remanded. The question the government argues in their brief that collateral estoppel applies because the Tennessee plea addressed factually guilt to the federal charges. That's incorrect. Factual guilt to the federal charges was not an issue in Tennessee. There was a single charge in the indictment, and though you'll see in parts of the record that they said there were two charges, it was actually an indictment with just one single charge, that specified he possessed images of a minor. It was referring to a singular person of a minor. He admitted to possessing less than 15 images. He was found guilty of sexploitation of eight.
Well, even, counsel, if you could just maybe skip ahead a little bit, even if he admitted factual guilt to the same objects in Tennessee, that's not really the question here, right? The question is whether he's collaterally estopped from challenging the Fourth Amendment validity of the warrants, right? Isn't that your argument?
Yes. That's what we're up. Yes. Whether or not he can challenge these warrants and whether or not he is violating stuff for doing so.
And am I correct? He didn't actually challenge any of the warrants in the Tennessee proceeding.
No, he did not. He worked to reach
He decided to plead guilty.
Yes.
Isn't that determinative for you on the collateral estoppel question?
No, Your Honor. We think that this action follows...
I think that was a softball. I think, isn't it determinative in your favor?
Yeah, oh, yes.
So, yes, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So because it wasn't fully litigated, even assuming a collateral estoppel would otherwise apply in this context, it's not appropriate in this case.
No.
So then why... So why isn't the government... then going to say, and what's wrong with the argument, that their good faith reliance on these warrants is nevertheless permissible?
No, thank you for moving me on, Your Honor. I think when we look at the good faith exception, while it does permit law enforcement officers to rely on a warrant, there are exceptions to this rule, and I think some of these exceptions apply here. An exception is when the magistrate judge abandons his judicial role. Another exception is when the warrant affidavit lacks an issue of probable cause. And if you look at what the warrants contain, the warrants contain an allegation from the complainant. The person was not a witness to the events. The person came up with an allegation. Now, we do know the name of the person who did that. We do know that the person was the mother of one of the victims. But we don't know how the complainant learned of this information.
Well, that amounts to, it sounds like the pre-Illinois v. Gates test, the Aguilar-Spinelli test for how warrants should be prepared, said you need to spell out your basis of knowledge. And it was applied very formally by courts that you really need to tell us how this person knew. But Illinois v. Gates said, look at all the circumstances. Is there a fair probability? Why isn't it reasonable to infer that someone, the mother of the alleged victim, we can infer that she got her information from the from her daughter?
Well, we are making an assumption of how. It may not have taken much to...
Is it an assumption or a reasonable inference? I mean, how else do you get the information from a child who allegedly has been exploited? I mean, most likely it would be the mother, right?
Well... The officer could have, you know, we're talking about teenagers here, while they were young teenagers.
Young teenagers, yeah.
The officer could have interviewed the teenagers and had that direct evidence.
Probably not without the mother being present or a parent being present.
Well, yes, but it still would have been a much more objective answer to
Is it unreasonable for a police officer to rely on a mother's allegations in this context?
I think we need to go just one step further. And we're not saying that it had to be a large step. We're not saying that...
What's the additional step?
Well, it may have been just hearing from the alleged
But isn't the trouble that when you suggest the police should have taken one small step in addition, we're not here to sit in review of whether there was probable cause around the supporting the warrants. We're here to say once the police brought this to a judge and the judge approved it, under Leon, there might not be probable cause, but we would still apply the good faith test. That's why you invoke the good faith test, because if there was probable cause, you wouldn't need the good faith rule of Leon. We're saying that there's a space of error surrounding the probable cause determination in which the magistrate was allowed to fall, and a police officer would still nevertheless be entitled to rely on it. So if this is so close to the line where, look, maybe you can infer, it seems reasonable to infer that if the mother came forward with all this information within a day of the events, who did she get all this from but the daughter, then it's reasonable to infer that the police officer would have thought the same.
Well, this is why we look at Wagner and Canfield, and we have to look just a little bit more to corroborate this. And that's what this court has allowed in those cases. And I think that's why this would address why these warrants wouldn't be enough under Leon.
Can I just ask you, draw your attention back to the collateral estoppel issue for just a moment.
Yes,
and I'm not, I want to just ask you if you could help us on the merits. We have not clearly addressed collateral estoppel's application in the Fourth Amendment context. I took from your brief, and I completely agree with you, that there would be due process concerns with applying collateral estoppel principles to the element of the crimes, because we need the jury to find each of those elements at trial. But is there any reason that we should not join those circuits that have said that in the Fourth Amendment context, in an appropriate case where it's actually litigated, collateral estoppel principles can properly apply?
I think if it's been litigated, we would get into another story. But here it was not litigated. My client in state court determined there's no reason to litigate it. He was more interested in coming to terms with his guilt regarding his Tennessee state charges and working out a reasonable plea deal that would allow him to avoid probation so that he could then, once he was done with his prison sentence, go on with his life.
But so, I guess I'm asking a hypothetical question. If in fact he had fully litigated it, just make that assumption, would there still be reason that we should pause to apply collateral estoppel in this context?
I think these issues should be fully litigated throughout, just to allow the due process to take place.
Okay, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Tiffany Lee, and I represent the United States. turn to good faith argument first. With respect to good faith and application of Leon here, as Judge Nardini pointed out, the point of Leon is to give that space. And here, we believe it's more than a close call because of the fact that Detective Brooks' affidavit at least hinted at it. Spelled out who, spelled out the what, spelled out the when, and maybe the where was not quite as precise, but they certainly knew where Mr. Jones lived. Given all of this and the, you know, the Supreme Court's dictate that we don't look at probable cause in a hyper-technical sense, that Jackson folks did what we want law enforcement to do. You know, provide an affidavit, go to a neutral magistrate, present the facts, and see whether or not a competent judge, in this case Judge Duggar, would sign off on the warrants. And Judge Duggar did. Accordingly, there is no evidence of bad faith that Detective Brooks relied on this erroneously when they did, when the Tennessee law enforcement did go out.
What about the argument that they could have done one more step and talk to the victims?
When it was argued below, actually, I believe the assistant responsible for the case did note that I believe the timing was that Detective Brooks actually had two sworn statements from the minor victims at that time. But I guess the question is, do we have enough here for probable cause? We do. Some judges might want more steps, other judges may want less steps. But the whole question is, we want law enforcement to go to a magistrate, present what they do, you know, present the facts of their case before the magistrate, and we want magistrates to view these things objectively with a detached eye and evaluate whatever is put in front of them. And Leon is basically saying, for appellate courts, you know, it's not their place to necessarily review in such great detail or require such so many steps or X steps in order to undergo their job of reviewing warrants. And unless there is evidence that this is a magistrate that's holding it in, or that, you know, law enforcement affirmatively misled the judge.
Can I ask you to turn your attention to the collateral estoppel question?
Yes.
And let's just assume for the sake of argument it applies. As an initial matter, do you agree that if it applies, it would be a function of Tennessee law on collateral estoppel that would drive whether it applies?
That's an interesting question. because I had viewed it in the lens of Greg, and Greg viewed it under the lens of New York State law in terms of looking at the law for collateral stuff. I think the answer is yes, because of the fact that the search, there's only one search here, so there's only one law enforcement action that we're looking at here. And, I think both Magistrate Judge Feldman here and District Court Judge Larimer looked to Greg to kind of lay out how it worked. And I think they viewed Greg's language regarding foreclosure of the challenge as one of timing, although there were aspects of collateral estoppel with that. And actually, because Greg goes through Talbot, it goes through Mena, and it goes through Precise. My apologies throughout the brief, for whatever reason, I called it Proseek. my apologies for that typo. But so we go through Talbot, and we know that we understand that the guilty plea does not waive these rights. What it does is it renders them constitutionally irrelevant. And
for purposes of the previous conviction, right?
Correct. For purposes of the previous conviction, it renders it constitutionally irrelevant. The the tricky part is in precise. When you're dealing with the subject matter of the second litigation, which is on law enforcement conduct, obviously, under those circumstances, you cannot say that the petitioner there had an opportunity to litigate the Fourth Amendment challenge because that person pled guilty to the possession of the drug offense or the manufacture of the drug offense. And Precise was somewhat saying, listen, you know, nothing is necessarily determined as a result of that guilty. Where that kind of comes into play under the circumstances of Gray, in which this court kind of hinted at following along the trajectory, because if you read Gray, if the gun had been found around the same time of the Metro car, the Gray court seemed to indicate that it would follow along notions of estoppel and foreclosure and say that any Fourth Amendment challenge with respect to the possession of the gun would have kind of followed along that.
Which I have to confess, if we got to that point, I was going to ask you, I've read that language, that line on page 166 of Gregg over and over again, and I still can't understand it. I know it's dicta. I know it's posing this hypothetical consideration that if the circumstances had been different then, so therefore it's dicta. But for the life of me, I don't understand how that conclusion follows from everything else that's been said in Gregg.
I think it follows because of the use of the word relevance in matter, and then Precise uses it too. But what it's saying is it renders irrelevant, MENA definitely says it, a guilty plea renders irrelevant any constitutional violation that's not logically inconsistent with a valid establishment of factual.
But let me ask you this then. I mean, you've seen this before, right? Defendant moves to suppress certain evidence. Defendant wins. The evidence is suppressed. Some other evidence comes up that conclusively proves their evidence, that their guilt, or for whatever reason. Let's say they decide that they're going to cooperate. Mm-hmm. They want to just nail down their liability. So even though all the evidence has been suppressed, they plead guilty anyway. I don't think we would say that even if there was a clear Fourth Amendment violation, that now the plea has somehow rendered that all irrelevant. We're just going to say that those are completely, they're two different issues, and one doesn't have an implication for the other, right? Pleading guilty doesn't necessarily imply that there's been no Fourth Amendment violation.
And that is true. However, I think there are, you know, again, it's the question of, I think, go back to logically inconsistent with, you know, the violation.
But that's what I mean. It's not necessarily logically inconsistent because I think we've all seen it, right? Cases where there is suppression, but the defendant pleads guilty anyway for other reasons. Maybe he pleads guilty to a lesser included offense. You know, you suppress the drugs. So the government drops a B1A conspiracy. The person pleads to a B1C, thinking, well, you know, maybe there's going to be other evidence and I'm just going to cap my losses here.
That's true.
But you wouldn't say that because that drug seizure, of course, was the thing that would have underlay the B1C anyway, that now those are logically inconsistent. You can't plead guilty and have had a Fourth Amendment violation. Of course you can have both.
And I see that, but there are contexts. Like, I think I'm looking at a view of elements. So, for example, someone confesses to admits to knowing possession of a firearm or illegal possession of a firearm. The fact that they are saying, my gun. Later on, we find out that gun was used in a murder prior to his conviction for possession of illegal possession of his firearm. It's the same gun. He's already admitted that it's his gun. And similarly here, what we are trying to advance under that Gray dicta is that Mr. Jones has admitted, I have
Well, but you would not be able to use the gun itself as evidence in the later murder if the gun itself was fruit of the, of say a Fourth Amendment violation. But you would be able to use his admission in the guilty plea against him as evidence, right? Because you would probably say that there's attenuation and it's not fruits, or maybe you would have an argument, I don't know. But assume you can't say that it's fruits of the unlawful seizure. But the gun itself, which remains the fruits of the unlawful seizure, would stay out, right? You'd be stuck with putting into evidence his admission at the guilty plea, but not having the gun that was the fruits.
I guess
that's what I'm saying. Why isn't that different?
But then there we see like a weird logical flip too, though. I mean, he's already admitted to possessing the gun. Why wouldn't we be able to? So it's the flip the other way in terms of, you know, what was mentioned in Manon in terms of, you know, the guilty plea of, you know, renders irrelevant those constitutional violations which are logically inconsistent with the admission of guilt.
But irrelevant for what purposes? It seems irrelevant for the earlier conviction, but not irrelevant for all time, for any purposes.
Your Honor, this is, again, a sticky area.
You know, couldn't you just bring a 1983 case later?
Sure.
Right? Say, you know what? Yeah, I committed the crime. Put me in jail. But you know what? You guys broke into my house. You broke down the door. You had no reason. You took the gun, and I want damages under Bivens.
But that's what Precise says, right? Precise said under those circumstances, it's not as if the Fourth Amendment challenge has been waived. Because, again, that fact of guilt is irrelevant to his legality of the search claim. His guilt in Precise, where he admitted to manufacturing drugs, you know, they're saying it's irrelevant. Again, the sticky term is relevant for which purposes, and, you know, under the evaluation of whether or not someone actually gives up their Fourth Amendment right or forecloses the Fourth Amendment right, because it really doesn't matter anymore going forward after the admission of factual guilt on that particular element. But in the alternative, the good faith Leon exception applies, and the district court's decision in order should be approved. Thank you.
I will be briefly focus just on the first part of Ms. Lee's argument, where she was addressing Judge Chin's question about one more step is necessary. The government pointed out that the officers did, in fact, have statements from the victims. This would have corroborated the information in the warrant, and probably I would not be here making this argument this time if that was the case. So here we do see the need for something more. It just wasn't done. And I think that this supports the need that why we need to go just a little bit further and corroborate these general allegations from secondhand sources. We can't just rely on having a name or a relationship, so something more needs to be done. Unless the panel has any more questions for me.
Thank you both, and we will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you, Ron.